To be a citizen of the United States of America in 2021 is, by most global and/or historical measures, a lottery win. The US is, and by some margin, the most economically, culturally, and militarily powerful nation ever gathered beneath one flag. Its institutions are robust, its businesses prosperous, its people free. And yet, you'll have noticed, a great many Americans are extraordinarily angry. This is not to suggest that there is nothing in the United States or the wider West worth getting angry about. There are certainly very real injustices and genuine inequalities. But is that the anger which last November nearly re-elected President Donald Trump, or this week attempted to recall California Governor Gavin Newsom, or is today, Saturday, September 18th, planning to once again besiege the Capitol building in Washington, D.C.? Abraham Lincoln's Secretary of State, William Seward, remarked towards the end of a previous eruption of American anger that there was always just enough virtue in this republic to save it, sometimes none to spare, but still enough to meet the emergency. More recently, President Joe Biden pleaded in his inaugural address that politics doesn't have to be a raging fire, destroying everything in its path. It may well be the case that most Americans agree with both sentiments, but they are right now a silent majority, certainly relative to the seething yahoos dominating the discourse. What are these people upset about? Is there any talking them out of it? And when we look at populist tantrums erupting across Europe, are they another American import or something else? This is the Foreign Desk.
I called it a day camp outing for bored middle class white people. Like, there's no sense that what they did is a serious crime and an attack on the fundamental democratic values of the United States of America. People died in this thing. This is a remarkably narcissistic movement of people in the United States and around the world who are almost childlike in their understanding of what freedom means.
People think that solutions can arrive very easily, and that's where you have the charismatic leader arriving and saying, I have the solution and I will bypass all the institutions to find the solution. So I think people have this kind of difficulties to read the complexity of how politics is done and the slowness of politics.
You're listening to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. Well, joining me now from Rhode Island is Tom Nichols, professor at the U.S. Naval War College and author of Our Own Worst Enemy, The Assault from Within on Modern Democracy. And we're joined by Evan Osnos, staff writer at The New Yorker and author of Wildland, The Making of America's Fury. Evan joins us from Washington, D.C. Tom, I will start with you. Does it strike you that the United States is actually an unusually angry country, or is it just a normally angry country, but it's so big and powerful and loud that the rest of us have to keep hearing about it?
I think there's some truth in the idea that anything we do sounds louder and angrier and worse than what happens in other places. But the sheer size and diversity of the United States means that a lot of our arguments with each other are actually hotter and louder and angrier. But the anger you're seeing in the United States isn't exceptional to the United States. It is happening in places like Italy or Brazil or India or Hungary. But everything in the United States is bigger and louder. So I think there is something different about what's going on in the United States, but it's been part of an, I think, global trend.
Evan, where do you think it comes from? Is there something, and this is a possibly not all the way thought through pet theory, that this is a hangover of being a revolutionary society in the same way that France is more notably theatrically angry than most of Europe, and indeed the only angry bit of Canada is Quebec?
I think there is an element of our founding myth that does inform the way that we conduct ourselves today, which is it's partly about a revolutionary story. Even literally on January 6th, you saw people dressed up in revolutionary costumes and a kind of harebrained homage to that. But I think there's also something else, which is you see this piece of American history where we sort of revere the frontier spirit, which is a image, almost a cartoon of an independent individualistic ethic that can, in certain forms, take on this particularly harsh edge. Look, let's state the obvious too, which is that we are also a uniquely armed society. We are in a class by itself in the number of weapons that people have accumulated. And the next closest country in line when it comes to personal armament is Yemen. And so the combination, exactly as Tom described, of scale and of the particular characteristics of our present age of anger, combined with the tools that we have to express it, is, I think, what gives us this volatile stew at the moment.
Because, Tom, one of the strangenesses of it in the American context is specifically an idea of victimhood, that these free citizens of a largely secure and prosperous democracy insist on feeling themselves to be oppressed to the extent that they will just literally make things up.
Yeah, there's two parts of that. I think that that is something that happens when you have an extremely high standard of living and affluence. The claim to grievance is actually the luxury of a middle-class society. People who are genuinely oppressed don't have a lot of time to spend going to the streets and talk about how oppressed they are. The notion that you are oppressed is something that can really only occur to you when you have enough time to kind of sit around and think about it and watch enough TV to come to that conclusion. But the other word, and this is, I think, part of the uniqueness of the American problem that we have to think about here, is race. And that a big part of what's going on is because of racial divisions and because of a peculiar kind of white anxiety that is taking a majority that knows it's eventually going to become a minority. America is becoming less white, less male, less middle-aged. And so white middle-aged males feel peculiarly and intensely aggrieved about those changes. And as Evan points out, they're armed, or they at least have been schooled to believe that they are Minutemen and Green Mountain Boys. And they also tend to cluster regionally in a way that does not happen in other countries, where you have increasingly a separation by class, education, and race in the United States. And so I think all of that sharpens this, but I think it's almost like it's a white male middle class midlife crisis happening on a national scale.
Evan, your book Wildland is a survey of the United States written after quite a long period of having been away from it. And that's an experience that always, I think, sharpens your perceptions of what is weird and what is wonderful about the place you call home. But when you started thinking about it and started doing the research, did it strike you that in the time you had been away, the United States had become noticeably angrier and stranger?
It took me a moment when I came home, I think, to fully absorb the scale of what was bubbling up. And partly, and this really does confirm Tom's instinct on this too, that I spent a lot of time in countries like China, Egypt, Iraq, places where people don't have the luxury of spending their evening in a Facebook group imagining the ways in which the universe has wronged them in some way. This kind of almost frantic determination to just get on with it, as people might say. And when I came home, I was really struck by the ways in which we had spun off of lots of subcultures of complaint. And I think the undertow is something that, as Tom put it, is this sort of larger demographic fact in this country, which is that you have particularly a generation of white men, and I'm speaking as one, who are in some cases kind of raging against the reality of change. And that is driving them berserk, to use a technical term, I think.
Tom, I want to go back to that idea that you floated of a sort of collective midlife crisis, which I guess a whole bunch of individual midlife crises have coalesced into something much bigger than themselves by, you know, growing a ponytail or buying a leather jacket or getting massively into motorcycles or whatever. It's usually because they want to do something that seems to them just fun and irresponsible. And I wonder, is it too trite to look at a lot of the people being performatively angry, up to and including those who stormed the Capitol building on January 6th, and basically thinking these are people who are enjoying themselves. This is fun for them. It's sort of their hobby. And maybe somewhere in the back of their heads is this idea that because I live in a sensible grown-up country, really, somebody will deal with it before it all gets too far out of hand.
I think on January 6th, you actually saw a lot of that. I mean, there were people in January 6th who really went in there and said, I'm here to hurt someone. But there were a lot of people. I called it a day camp outing for bored middle class white people. One of them said, life or death, I'm going in, and then Instagrammed it. and said, and remember, I'm a really good realtor. When I get back to Texas, I can sell your house. I talk about this in the book. One of them was arrested and said, well, gosh, Your Honor, I really need to have pretrial release because I have to go to a work retreat in Mexico. Like, there's no sense that what they did is a serious crime and an attack on the fundamental democratic values of the United States of America. People died in this thing. The Capitol was breached for the first time since 1814. This is a remarkably narcissistic movement of people in the United States and around the world who are almost childlike in their understanding of what freedom means. It means that freedom is whatever I want to do. I'm the most important person in the world. I'm the hero of my own story. And there couldn't possibly be consequences for this because everybody gets it that this is just TV.
Evan, the idea of the United States becoming a fundamentally less serious country is a recurrent theme, certainly of Tom's book, Our Own Worst Enemy. But it's interesting when you frame that observation, accurate though it doubtless is, against your book, Wildland, which is bracketed by these two great traumas, the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001, and the pandemic, which began in 2020. What was your eventual read on why two traumas of that scale made the country less serious rather than, as might be expected, a more serious place?
Well, in fact, what we see is what I would describe as a failure of tragic imagination. That's how I put it in the book. This idea that if you're Jared Kushner or you're Donald J. Trump, your life has been a cascade of well-lubricated failures from one experience to the next. And as a result, you simply literally can almost not imagine true crisis and true failure. So when a deadly pathogen arrives in the United States, your initial instinct is to say, oh, it'll be fine. The market will take care of it. We'll be okay. The institutions will step in. Jared Kushner says, I'm going to bring in some of my guys and we're going to fix it. There's a haunting parallel here to the failure of imagination that actually contributed to 9/11, because it was the inability to imagine that a man in a cave could somehow challenge the world's most powerful nation. And the failure of imagination we see today is the idea that casting a ballot for somebody like Trump could actually undermine the system that we hold dear. And I know people who they should know better. And they did it because they thought the country's strong, we're resilient. And it's almost like a kind of mythology about ourselves that would fit on the back of a cereal box, except for the fact that resilience takes work and it takes a commitment to seriousness and an understanding of the gravity of the choices we make as people and as voters.
Evan Osnos and Tom Nichols, thank you for joining us. We will have more from you both later in the show. You're listening to The Foreign Desk. This is The Foreign Desk on Monocle 24. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is the French political scientist, Dr. Marlène Larroel. Marlène is director of the Institute for European, Russian and Eurasian Studies at the George Washington University. Marlène, this show obviously is mostly about the kind of rage we have seen of late in the U.S., but of course it's not just the U.S. We are seeing and have seen similar phenomena here in Europe. Does it seem to you that it's broadly the same thing, or are Europeans finding completely different things to get angry about?
I think it shares a lot of features each time in different cultural and political contexts. And of course, a big difference between the US and Europe is the political system in the US, because it's a bipartisan political system. It's make that the results of election will be quite different. In Europe, you tend to have, depending on the country, more multiple parties in power. And so when this kind of populist rage arrives in power, it's usually in Europe as part of a coalition government, while in the US, the goal is for populist leader to penetrate the Republican establishment. So that make a quite different political context, but the reasons of the populist rage are relatively similar.
One of the things that we are discussing with our other guests in this show is what those real reasons actually are, whether or not there are genuine economic or societal injustices which are animating this kind of populist rage, or whether it is, frankly, just bored, complacent people seeking either meaning or entertainment. As you will probably recall, France's President Charles de Gaulle, circa the Great Insurrections of 1968, merely shrugged in the classic Gallic style and said, France is bored. Is there something to that, do you think?
No, honestly, I belong to the one who think that they are genuine grievance, but I also think that it's a global phenomenon of the change of media and ecosystem that make that politics maybe resemble more and more to entertainment, or politics is no more understandable for average citizens. And I think that's a key element to understand why people suddenly feel like they are no more part of the cities. And then that opened the door for, of course, their support to a lot of populist leaders.
Should any blame for that be directed to the voters? I mean, I understand what you're saying about people wanting to be entertained by their politics, but in a couple of places in Europe, Italy, Ukraine, you could even argue the United Kingdom, people have elected actual comedians to be in charge of things.
Well, I think it's telling us mostly that the high level of distrust toward classical institutions, people don't trust anymore state institutions, the parliament, the justice, they don't trust classic media anymore. And I think the social media and the television have created kind of personalized politics. So that kind of birth of this kind of infotainment, kind of mixed of information and entertainment, make that for people, it's sometimes unclear why a politician should be a professional technocrat and wouldn't be any kind of guy coming from the street, or a humorist or an actor. So I think it's telling us a lot about the blurriness of the professionalization of politics in the current cultural system we are living in.
But how much of that is down to a fairly widespread reluctance or refusal to make the effort to understand politics enough to take it seriously? Do you not think that there's a lot of people, I think, attracted to these populist insurrections because finding and discussing solutions to problems is very often very difficult and very boring, whereas being out on the street, being angry and throwing cafe tables at the gendarmes is great fun and really gratifying?
I mean, I think only a minority of those who are in the streets think that it's fun. I think for the majority of those who are in the street, it's just that they don't have any more the keys to understand politics, right? It's become too complex for them. It's too technocratic. It's look very opaque. It's too slow. Also, people think that solutions can arrive very easily. And that's where you have the charismatic leader arriving and saying, I have the solution and I will bypass all the institutions to find the solution. So I think people have this kind of difficulties to read the complexity of how politics is done and the slowness of politics. So I wouldn't put all the blame on the voter. I think it's also an issue on the political class globally and the system in which we work to find a way to talk to average citizen in a language that still makes sense. And the fact that, for example, local newspapers are disappearing, I mean, that's a big issue because for average citizen, the big politics is not what is happening in the capital city or for Europe in Brussels. It's what is happening in your own city. If we miss that local level because we don't have local news media, then people don't see it anymore and cannot understand it.
But is there a way any politician now can still bridge that gap while still being a responsible leader, acknowledging that their job is complicated and difficult? And obviously in France next year, you are likely to have a test case of this because there is a very decent chance that France's presidential election will boil down to a choice between the incumbent Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen of the somewhat rebranded Front National, or National Rally, as she's now calling it. Is there any way that the, for want of a better word, more sensible politician can make that pitch sound any more seductive than it does?
I think if we look at surveys in the case of France that we were mentioning, we see, for example, that the way Macron has been able to handle the vaccination dynamic has been really well received by a lot of citizens. We, of course, have anti-vaccination and anti-sanitary protests, but I think there are still ways to speak to citizens, and there is no other way than to try to speak to citizens, right? Because it's a democratic system. You have to give them the floor on one way or another. But of course, now we are in such deadlock situation that the risk is to have Marine Le Pen being really able to get a lot of voters, not only because they support her specifically and her program, but just because they are angry at Macron.
Does it strike you that there are parts of the left, especially in Europe, that have drifted as well into this strange, seething irrationality, and that perhaps by now the two are feeding off each other?
Well, I wouldn't say they are feeding each other, but for sure there is a leftist populism that is also on the rise, challenging the establishment, but with another set of arguments. I mean, sometimes the arguments may overlap, for example, in being anti-EU, in being in favor of kind of nation state sovereignty to be taken back from multilateral institution. But of course, on what is the core issue for the rightist populist movement, which is everything around protecting the nation from immigrant and protecting the traditional family, the leftist populism, in on the contrary, a very liberal one. It's a multicultural one, open to migrant and open to LGBT rights. So there you still have the right versus left divide. But indeed, on some other issues, you don't see the divide anymore. You see the new divide between populist group and what they see as being the establishment, in quotation marks.
Marlene Larrowell at George Washington University, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Evan Osnos and Tom Nichols. Tom, in this second half of the show, let's have a bit of a think about where we are now and where all this might be going. As you'll be aware, there was this conventional wisdom, this optimistic conventional wisdom that took hold after Donald Trump lost in 2020, that him not being president anymore would kind of let the air out of everything, that the fever would break, that the metaphor would unmix. Do you see any indication that this is what is happening?
No, I actually think we're in more danger now than we were a few years ago. I was one of those people who thought maybe when Trump was gone, the embers would cool a bit, but I didn't count on an entire institutionalized American political party that would be dedicated to using Trump's methods to farm money and votes out of people by keeping them perpetually enraged about everything. Maybe I underestimated the degree to which millions of American voters have literally become, and I use this word advisedly, almost psychotic in their inability to conceive reality. Because I spent my life having political arguments with people. I rarely ever had to argue with anybody about the nature of shared visions of reality, whether or not you can actually inject a microchip into somebody's arm. I just didn't have a lot of those discussions. But that's where we are now.
Evan, why do you think that fever won't break among clearly many millions of Americans as individuals, that they keep believing things and being told things? Is it just on a grand scale, the sunk costs fallacy? You know, as we know, once you get people believing a little bit of something, it's much easier for them just to go the whole hog than admit to themselves and to others they were wrong. Or is there some sort of, as Tom suggests, some national scale psychosis at large?
I think there is a kind of wholesale departure from the realm of established fact by a large portion of Americans, which is a terrifying observation. And it didn't happen overnight. Trump was a catalyst. He was the primary agent, but it started earlier. You have to go and look at things like the invention of the myth of voter fraud, which goes back a decade, which was a Republican Party strategy to try to seed doubt among voters in the integrity of elections. And it worked to an astonishing degree. Long before Donald Trump, he was still hosting a game show at this point when they started this idea. Then you have the birther fiction, the idea that the duly elected president of the United States is a crypto-Muslim born in Kenya, which was an idea that was also then thrust into public life in conservative circles in a way that poisoned people's minds. And I think for a certain hardcore component of the kinds of people that we saw on January 6th, and we'll certainly see again, they have really shuffled off of what we would recognize as the orienting landmarks of reality, science, fact, institutional heft, the scientific method. These things don't matter anymore. What matters is this inward faith.
Tom, we are rapidly approaching the "but what is to be done" section of the program, and it is a difficult question to answer because, as well as the difficulty of attempting to reason people out of that which they did not reason themselves into, there is also the fact that a lot of this strikes me as really motivated by just plain blind furious hatred, not just of entirely imaginary enemies, but also of one's fellow citizens who they believe in league with those imaginary enemies.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to reason anybody out of anything. I think at this point, a lot of those people are way too far up that tree ever to climb down. The good news is they are a minority in almost every country, including the United States. And the answer is outvote them, reinforce the guardrails of constitutional democracy. Don't overreact to them by putting in measures that are just as oppressive as the ones they would expect you to, which I think is a mistake that a lot of people, particularly on the left, want to make about doing this. And I think that we're just headed through a kind of a dark tunnel for a while, that some of which will be solved by demography, that the most illiberal elements in every country, whether it's India, the UK, the United States, it tends to be people 55 and 60 and over, which is another way of saying the kids are all right. But it's going to be an incredibly dangerous 20 years where there will be potentially violence and, again, overreactions that could put into place unconstitutional or undemocratic or illiberal measures that are put there in a panic. Every time someone says ban Fox News, my answer to them is calm down. The majority is actually quite sensible, and this will pass if we have the steadfastness and stoicism to let it pass and to keep showing up at the ballot box to make sure that it passes.
Evan, in the meantime, is there anything that the media should have learnt from the last 20 years about how it reports this stuff? Do you think the big city media, though, was perhaps too indulgent, if well-meaningly so, in reporting and amplifying stuff that got passed off as legitimate concerns or economic anxieties?
I think there was a sort of rapid learning curve when people had to figure out not only how do you write about rural America, which people had been avoiding for a long time, but then also how do you write about far-right extremism? And there was this brief and I think very kind of embarrassing set of glamour shots of white nationalists who were sort of described as almost treated like public intellectuals in a particularly gross way. And I think there has been a much greater understanding now of how ideas move through a food chain and which parts of the ecosystem need oxygen from the media in order to survive and how do you deprive them of that while also not ignoring something that is bubbling up in a dangerous way. And I will tell you that I think one of the things that we are seeing now, too, on a political level, is a willingness, really finally, it's taken a while, but particularly on the vaccine, to say to people without going too far and instituting a regime that would be punitive, but to say, look, you have to get vaccinated. Enough of this. This is now a basic requirement of citizenship in that sense. And enough of this indulging in your alternatives to science. And I think that's a step forward.
Tom and Evan, thank you both for joining us. That was Tom Nichols of the U.S. Naval War College. His latest book, Our Own Worst Enemy, The Assault from Within on Modern Democracy, is available now. Thanks also to Evan Osnos of The New Yorker. His book, Wildlands, The Making of America's Fury, is also available wherever fine books are sold. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Emma Searle and Christy Evans. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.